Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, presumably. Maybe. Probably not, presumably. Yeah, shouldn't presume that. Welcome back to another, maybe not presumably, exciting second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach, where we'll talk about such exciting and inspiring subjects as inflation, employment, and things like that. Last hour, we ended kind of halfway through a subject, and it's a subject that I think bears some more conversation. Philip sent a kind of a complicated series of questions and concerns that kind of boil down to what is the long term that we should be expecting to the health of the economy based on the spending at the federal level, the forced lockdowns, the ongoing and then stopping payments of unemployment, additional insurance to things. And we spent a chunk of the last hour talking about how the stimulus actually did a lot of good for the economy. The long-term implication of this is still out there. We haven't touched that yet. But the short-term of it is it did something fantastic. It made our downturn, our recession from the pandemic be 1 month long. We referred back to 1920 when the Spanish flu was presumably the cause of that recession, and it lasted much longer. It didn't have any stimulus from the government. There was no such thing as unemployment insurance at the time. There certainly wasn't long-term care benefits, and our health situation was much worse. So there's a lot of other variables in there. But something that we can see across the world today is that countries that didn't have the kind of federal backup, kind of insurance money for the disaster, are struggling hard right now. Very hard, because it's not like they didn't have the same things happen there. They just didn't have the federal backup. Now, where did we get that money? Where did the United States get the money to flush into the system to give us the stimulus and to cause the houses to stop being foreclosed on and to cause people to not be evicted for rent? And where's this money coming from? What is the PPP loans, the stimulus checks that people got? Well, it came from borrowing. And we spent a chunk of the first part of the hour talking about the strangeness of how low the interest rates are right now at the Treasury level. Interest rates are falling and have been falling for weeks. We're back down to where we were in the fall of last year. And this is something we mentioned in the newsletter, that if you missed refinancing back when rates were below 3%, well, they're back there again. So now, you need to have a good credit to get that refinance, and that's a important factor that everybody needs to be looking at, is that during this big boom for refinancing, we didn't see a lot of low-income people getting refinanced. In fact, it's really high-income, very, very high credit score people are the ones that drove that mortgage market. So what was the impact? What is the long term on this? So we can see that unemployment's recovering, so that there's a lot more. Well, I should say employment's recovering. Unemployment's de-recovering, in that we're putting people back to work. Businesses are starting back up. There's a mismatch there, and that a lot of the jobs that are being looked for aren't the jobs that are available, and vice versa. But there's as many jobs available as people looking for jobs at this point. This is phenomenal, because if you look back at other times in history where there wasn't this kind of an insurance backup, and I'm referring to the government as insurance in this case, you see a much, much longer, protracted, more painful recovery. So we had this government spending based on borrowing that other people in the world and ourselves deemed was a safe bet. We were loaning money to the government. That's where they get it. This is something I think most people lose track of. This. The vast majority, not just the majority, but the vast majority of the debt that the U.S. government owes is owed to the American people. They're the ones that hold those bonds. There's a lot of other countries that also own bonds, but we're talking about a third of the overall debt. The rest of it belongs to us. We're the ones that think the government's safe enough to keep loaning it money, and we think it's safe enough that were even willing to take lower and lower interest rates to do it. So what that means is that the people that are loaning this money believe that they're going to get the money back, even though that the rate that they're getting is below that of inflation. And you're muted.
Another way of explaining that I like, is if you go to the bank and you try to get a loan and you have too much debt outstanding, they don't think you're going to be at some point be able to pay it back, or they're going to have to write down some of the debt, which is a form of inflation, they won't make you a loan. And if you believe that the marketplace is, if you like we do, and we believe that the capitalist marketplace is long-term quite intelligent, the collective wisdom of all the people who are buying bonds, for example, is a quite intelligent net result. Then you look at the fact that the people who are loaning money to the United States for 10 years are charging 1.279% per year to loan that money to the United States. And knowing that inflation is going to be less than that, going to be more than that, I mean, with a great deal of confidence, they know they're going to lose money on the loan. They think the United States credit is so good that they'll loan money to the United States for 30 years. A 30-year bond is below 2%.
Again,
a lot of people.
We look back 50 years. That's way below the last 50-year average inflation rate.
A lot of people, internationally and domestically, are loaning money to the United States for 30 years or 10 years or 20 years at rates below inflation. So the collective wisdom of the world is we didn't borrow too much money and we're going to pay it back. And there's another, can I go on?
Yeah, I've got one more thing to add to this too. Go ahead.
Okay. If we allow the tax code to just run without messing with it, other than the 15% minimum tax that President Biden has proposed, which I think is a good idea for corporations, we will pay this debt back, because in the end of 2025, tax rates go for individuals go back up to where they were. The corporate tax rate stays at 21%, but if we have a 15% minimum tax, in other words, no matter how many tax write-offs a company has, if it reports profits,
you got to pay 15%. That's the flat bottom.
Got to pay a minimum of 15%. You figure all that together. If we don't borrow a lot more money,
I have to throw this in real quick. Sure. Sorry, I said it was the flat bottom, which is only allowed to be said about boats or tax rates. Please do not refer to any of your colleagues or significant others with that terminology. Okay, now back to you.
Flat bottom?
Yes. Now don't call me that. What? I just said.
I heard a reference to an egg with a flat bottom the other day.
Mm. See?
Otherwise, it would roll around. So the point is, by the end of 2025, our economy should have recovered very nicely. It should be on a big roll. And if somewhere along the way we allow taxes to rise,
which it's set to do in 2025.
Which is set to do under the Trump Tax Act, which was called something, Economic Recovery Act or
no,
something. It's always called something.
Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
Oh, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act will raise taxes, which is kind of backwards, in to the end of 2025. By the end of the 2020s, we'll probably be running a surplus and be paying back the debt.
So
on the other hand, this debt currently is financed at rates well below inflation. So people are actually paying the United States to loan the United States money. So I don't think there's any immediate threat from the debt.
Right. So that goes on to the next question. And this is probably the biggest concern. This is what Philip wrapped up the questions with, is I'm concerned about higher inflation and quite possibly my employment in the future. So we just covered what economists like to say in aggregate, and it just means across the board averages, which are extremely good at looking at the big picture and very uncomfortable when you look at a micro level, at a human level, rather than the average of all these people. The truth is that this year we're going to see a spike in inflation. We've already beginning to see it. It's going to be a big one. And it's the same kind of spike in inflation that we saw at Katrina around New Orleans. Every natural disaster has this happen. This is why we have price gouging rules, because plywood shouldn't go up by 300% because there's a hurricane there, except that it does, because you've got to get the plywood out there somehow. Well, the government says you can't overly profit from this stuff. When there's a disaster that's this bad across the board, there's going to be some over-profiting, some gouging. But the reality is that the supply chain is all messed up. The people that generally have been manufacturing for us at this point are on again, off again, in lockdown in China. This is something that's hard to cover because the United States and China are so at odds on so many things right now, but it's still going on. There are rolling lockdowns taking place across China constantly right now. Major metropolitan centers just getting shut down. And we're not tracking that here very well. As far as Western culture goes, we're not looking over there and saying what factories are open today. We've got these great figures where we're tracking how many rigs are open for fracking and how many new rigs are being made. Manufacturing facilities in China are this big gray area that's really hard to know. Even if you're the one whose factory is being shut down, you may not find out about it for a week. You just, the numbers start looking weird and you go, what's going on? And you call and nobody answers the phone at your own factory. So supply chain issues are going to continue until enough of the world is immune or vaccinated. So just keep that in mind, that we're going to have continuations of spikes of inflation. The reason why we're not concerned long term about inflation is because we're seeing productivity growth that is so completely off the charts that there's no real good comparison era except for right after the GI Bill hitting after World War II. We're seeing people getting better, automating, doing more with software, doing more with equipment than they've ever done before. When that happens, that's the kryptonite to inflation. If you can make more things for the same amount of money, then it's really hard to charge more money for it, especially if you're in competition with other people that are doing the same thing. The things that have kept inflation low for the last decade and a half is that if you raised your prices, somebody else in the world would come up with a lower price for the same product. Now, somebody else in the world was usually in China, but not always. So if you raise the price on your rubber boat or your dinghy, then somebody in China would say, hey, we can sell it for less. And it's the same product because it's made at the same manufacturing facility. That has been the kryptonite to inflation till now. Well, now we have these supply chain issues that are causing these instant inflation hikes. Also, remarkably, instant deflation hikes. There's places where you really can't sell certain items because you can't send it to the place that normally would be buying it. We see this in automobiles right now. The chips are coming out. It's slowing down production. We look at unemployment right now. This is something we also mentioned in the newsletter. We had a jump in additional people seeking unemployment protection, unemployment insurance, about 41,000 people. And when you dig into that, those are people that are not able to work in the auto industry because the chips aren't there for them to be working. So the plants are shut down. So they're seeking unemployment insurance. Is that temporary?
Chips are down.
Chips are down. Yep. Some people have them on their shoulders, which is just as bad. When the chips are down, these folks got laid off. And there's another big article in the Wall Street Journal that some of these people won't have a job when the chips come back. Not because the companies are going to be unprofitable, but because of what we mentioned last hour, many, many, many jobs are switching over from internal combustion to electric and battery at Ford, at General Motors, at all of the major manufacturing facilities for automobiles that support those companies. That these experts, these engineers that are highly skilled at the internal combustion engine, about getting the absolute most gas mileage out of these minor explosions that happen at high speed, aren't going to have a job when they come back for after the chips. They're retiring early. They're getting buyouts. They're getting laid off with big packages. This is something that's going to continue for a while because technology is being replaced by another technology. This happened in televisions. Curtis Mathis went away. It was a big deal. I mean, they made furniture that was also a TV. When you have to have pallbearers for your television, that's a statement about where you were at the time. You have to have six people come to carry your television in using poles, and you could place your whole dinnerware set across the top of the television, and the screen was 12 inches across. So, little hyperbole in there. Little hyperbole. But this is what we're seeing. So employment and inflation we see as a short-term thing. These supply chains will get worked out and we'll get more efficient. So the long term is we're likely to go back to things being cheaper year after year because of the productivity gains. Now comes the last and maybe most important concern that Philip raised, and I'd really like your input on this too, because I'm doing a soliloquy rather than a dialogue here.
But you're doing a good soliloquy.
Thank you. Is that he's concerned about employment in the future, personally and for people that he knows. And the reality of that, and I'll just touch on it briefly and then hand it over to you, is that your employment will not be in jeopardy if you train yourself to train yourself. If you're willing to continue to learn new things, your employment will not be in jeopardy. If you're willing to continue to invest in your own knowledge and your own skill set, no matter what happens to technology, you can convert with it and likely to a better position in the future. That's hard when you're looking at it and saying, my job may be gone. But if you're truly concerned, start looking at what you can learn that will guide you to the next steps after whatever it is that you're doing is no longer there. That's vital, and it doesn't matter what place in history you are, that's true. Invest in yourself and in your own knowledge, and you'll have the ability to retool and move on to the next step, to evolve, if you will.
My mother-in-law, my wife's mother, who died 20 years ago, had a sign that she had up in her on her wall that we still have up on the wall.
The one that said no roller skating on the ceilings?
No, not that one.
Not that one. Oh, okay.
Said, look awake. You could be replaced by a button. And she was talking about it because she collected buttons, but that's beside the point. If you can be replaced by a button, your job is in danger. And that's something to consider. If you're doing something that's boring and repetitive, eventually a computer will come along to do your job. If you're doing something that requires thinking and innovation, computers don't do that very well. As a matter of fact, they do that terribly. So as far as job, and the other side of it is, Jake was talking about from a very practical point of view, and I'm talking about a very practical point of view. If you're in a boring, terrible job,
you should move before you're laid off anyway.
You should be educating yourself and moving on to something else. And people are doing that, by the way, across the country.
Yeah, we're seeing that across the numbers.
But net in the economy, changes in technology, improvements in technology don't decrease jobs. They increase jobs. They increase better paying jobs. The economy, this economy that we have in the United States, because it's not centrally controlled, does a lot of things that other economies don't do. For example, there was a push to raise the minimum wage a couple of years ago to $15, and it was resisted terribly and resisted forcibly. And I don't know whether it was good or bad that it was resisted. We raised the federal official minimum wage to $15. De facto, you can't hire anybody for less than $15 an hour at this point. So the marketplace has taken this into its own hands and raised the minimum wage effectively to $15. McDonald's is paying $15 an hour for hamburger flippers. Amazon is paying $15 an hour starting wages. Walmart is paying $15 an hour starting wages.
And that
the marketplace tends to take care of itself.
A lot of people say, well, that's political moves. No, it's just hard to hire anybody that's quality if you pay less than that. It's just really, really hard to find anybody that will work for less than that at this point. So this is a factor of how the marketplace fixes this. And I've got a wrap up for this that I think will encapsulate all of it. How do you protect yourself against inflation? How do you protect yourself against your job going away? How do you protect yourself against technology shifts? And there's one way that throughout history has worked, at least in places that have personal property rights, and that's ownership. I know this seems like a very basic concept, and it is. Inflation, it's historically best counterpart, it's best thing that keeps up with it, is owning companies that have to evolve with inflation, that have to raise their prices with inflation. It isn't gold. You can look at gold and inflation, and it's all over the charts. There's no easy answer. I'll just buy gold, and that'll hedge me against it, because it's got its own volatility. We are like 5% of the overall market in gold at this point when you look at how much India and China buy and sell gold. So our inflation is irrelevant to gold's prices at this point when that much demand is coming from other places. So what is it? It's ownership in the economy, in the stock market, in the bond market, in in real estate that is not just raw land, that has some kind of built-in value to it. A house, as long as you're keeping the house up, your rent should go up with inflation. Your stock prices historically have gone up with a certain amount of gains on top of inflation. So ownership is the way you preserve yourself, and long-term, what you should be trying to do to protect your own employment is to reach financial independence. And I know a lot of people scoff at this. This is something that we were talking about this before the program, that's not possible. It's out of reach for my generation, whatever your generation is. And this is because every generation's got a headline: baby boomers, financial independence out of generation X, financial independence out of reach. It's to make you scared and read the article. The reality is that we see proof that that is not true every day, because we've got clients that are not, they were not some kind of instant millionaire. They didn't get into some startup and blow up and found some major company and now are in orbit over the planet. They had a job like other people had jobs, but they had a disciplined approach to investing in ownership and in their own potential. They invested in their own knowledge and they invested in their own ownership. And they did it consistently with relatively small amounts of money that grew with them over the years. And they've reached financial independence. It's hard, but that's really it. If you've got to take ownership of yourself, your own capabilities, increase them and improve them as much as you can, and take ownership in the economy around you. And that, while it's long term and it certainly wouldn't help you in a short term emergency, the long term is that is the way to alleviate the concerns that you have here, is invest in yourself and invest in your future.
Live below your standard of living.
Yeah. Don't spend more than you make. Keep savings on hand. Invest for the long term in both your own brain and in your portfolio. And when I say the marketplace, I'm not limiting it to the stock market. That would be absurd. There's so much in the marketplace, including your own employment. And the more ownership you take in that, the more safety you have against these things that are in the email about the concern. What the government does, if you are in high demand, it really doesn't matter, because you're still going to be in high demand. Put yourself in high demand, and that's the alleviation. And I know, you know, we're supposed to be finance and talk to you about, well, if you invest in this company right here and do these things, these simple 10 steps. Well, no, it's simpler than that. It doesn't go in a step order. You've got to invest in yourself and in your future. That's it. Treat yourself like you need to support yourself in the future. And unfortunately, that simple concept is not well taught. There. I think I've hit that one.
I'm going to use something that is not appropriate for using for selling securities.
Securities being stocks?
Yeah.
Okay. What's that?
Something called the rule of 72, and I want you to think about it, folks. If you're listening and you're not investing regularly through your 401k or IRA or whatever. I was talking to a guy the other day who doesn't have an IRA. He's working. He's not investing through a retirement plan. He's not investing in an IRA. Got a new family, and he just doesn't seem to think that that's important. I explained to him that if he were set up an IRA this year, when he retires, the $1,000 or so that I said, if you put $1,000 in an IRA this year and the market, now this is the big if, and you were to put it in equities, in a mutual fund, and you left it alone until you retire because of his age, the fact that you didn't put $1,000 in this year will cost you about $128,000. And he just looked shocked. And I said, I'm not going to make any guarantee about the future, but I can tell you that doing nothing about the future, if you backed up 30 years or 35 years to your age and you didn't put in $1,000 in a 401k or an IRA this year, you wouldn't have $128,000 of value now. And it wasn't an unusual 10 years. It wasn't unusual 30 years. The stock market in the United States on average tends to rise on average. And this is an important thing to say, on average, because some years it goes down for years at a time, about 7% a year. And that doubles your money every 10 years. And you can get out a pad of paper, take $1,000 and start doubling it every 10 years and see what happens. But the important thing is to be investing towards your retirement, towards your financial independence now. I've had people come into the office recently to do reviews who started putting money into retirement accounts many years ago, 30, 40 years ago, and they are very happy people. If it wasn't for COVID, they'd be traveling around the world. They'd be enjoying, they're still enjoying life. They are definitely financially independent. They don't have to work in the, into their old age. They took jobs that had retirement systems. They invested in their retirement systems in addition, and they have made it. They're on top of the world. They're in that probably upper 5% of the nation. They didn't inherit any money. All they did was save and invest consistently for many, many years. And that's just so important. It's so critically important. And yet people who are young in many cases just don't get it, that they need to be investing every month now. They need to take a minimum, no rule of thumb, and works 10% of your income and plow it into long-term investments and do so every month with just keep on keeping on. And it will, if you remember me saying this and you're young today and you're listening to me, you'll look back in 30 years and say that was one of the most intelligent things you ever heard said.
Yeah. I wish there was another approach to this, because there isn't a get rich quick answer to this. It's true in employment. It's true in inflation. It's true no matter what we're talking about. That disciplined approach of I am going to continue to make myself better, whether that means improving my property or improving myself internally, that is so consistent across the board. And what's amazing about this is that Nobel Prizes keep getting issued in economics on this subject, where people are like, oh, really? If you own stuff, it's better for you. Wow. Douglas North, one of our favorite economists, between the two of us, we've read everything he's put out easily. And well, not easily. It is not easy reading, but easily read everything that he's put out. And he covers that. Well, Daniel Kahneman, behavioral economist, the one that, you know, the psychologist that won the economics Nobel Prize, said basically the same thing, is that if you just continue to take ownership over your own decision-making process again and again, then you tend to make better decisions. We keep being surprised by it, but it's the reality of the world that we live in. This is something that both the Republicans and the Democrats have said at different times. And that is, we're about personal responsibility. The reason why both political parties keep coming back to that over the different years is because it's true. It just really comes down to that as its most simple form. If you're not taking personal responsibility for your own future, if you are truly dependent on each job, then you need to build yourself into a place where that's not true. That's not easy to do. It's because everyone trains you. Go out, get a job. If you don't have a job, go get another job. You need to have a longer term plan that goes across planning for creating your own independence. And that's the investment side. And we're very prejudiced on this subject. And this week I saw more headlines on the negative end of this than I have in quite a long time about not possible to reach financial independence. Millennials will never get it. Generation X suffering. And that's true for a lot of the people that weren't planning in Generation X, but it's not too late. It's never too late to begin making a difference in yourself. I keep hearing people say, and this is something I heard as a kid when Elder Baldy would talk to people about investing, and they'd be like, yeah, I'll invest when I get some extra money to do it with. How many times have you heard that one?
Oh, I can't tell you the number of people who've told me that.
I'll wait till I win the lottery, then I'll invest. Well, you won't need to invest if you win the lottery. You're already financially independent. I mean, not that it should dissuade you, but it's not the same. It's like saying I'll clean my room when I get a vacuum. Well, if you never get a vacuum, you're going to have a pretty dirty room.
And what people don't understand, particularly when they're younger, is they have millions of dollars that is going to be spent over the next 10 or 20 or 30 years. The question is, what are they going to spend it on? Are they going to spend it on something that goes away, or are they going to spend it on something that makes more money?
Right.
When I first came into the business of giving investment advice in 1982, I read a book by Vanita Van Caspel, and the one quote that jumps out to me all these many years later is, money makes money, and the money makes more money. And if it's invested, that's true. If it's not invested, that's not true. But you have to be willing to persist through wobbles, through dips, through crunches, and continue to stay invested. That's what investing is all about. Which brings me to another subject. That's a pretty good segue.
Yeah.
I could change subjects.
We're going to play some commercials at some point as well. Yeah, this is a good segue.
You're going to see more wobbles in the market. You're going to see more wobbles in the economy. We've had a nice smooth ride, relatively speaking, this spring, as we've recovered from the winter pandemic. It's amazing. It was only 6 months ago that we were thinking that the pandemic was as bad as it was going to get, and then it kept getting worse. But you're going to see whiplash in the economy. You're going to see stops and starts, bottlenecks, chokes, unpleasant things occur, and you're going to see the market wobble around. Just be prepared for that. It's not a smooth ride. And at some point, I have faith, and this is purely faith. I see nothing that would cause a correction at this point. But I can tell you at some point we're going to get a correction. I say that with a great deal, not with certainty, but with a great deal of faith, because a market, you go back and look through history for a market double, and we're like 97% up from where we were at the bottom, and 100% we'll hit a market double. Having a market double without a correction is an exceptionally rare thing. And at some point, something will come along, and it will scare, it will spook investors, and the stock market will drop 10%. And you will see the doomsday scenario pop up all over the TV, all over the newspapers. If you read newspapers, wherever you see it, it's going to be, get out of the market now. Don't. I'm just telling you, just be prepared. It's going to happen. Have a plan. And eventually, we'll come back out of that again and probably do better than we did before. And it's just something that I keep saying this over and over again, but it's something to be aware of in the middle of a bull market, because we are in a raging bull market right now by any definition, which, by the way, based on current earnings, not on past earnings, is not overpriced yet. I think Morningstar is saying it's 4% overpriced, which is not significant.
Yeah.
But by the metrics that we use, this is a normal pricing for a bull market. And I think you can be comfortable that somebody will determine that it's too highly priced. Matter of fact, on Monday, a lot of people thought it was too highly priced and started selling off. And there are going to be other attempts at that too. Just relax. Take it easy. The economy is going like gangbusters, whatever gangbusters is.
I think it has to do with the 1930s when the FBI went out with Tommy guns and attacked it, really tore it up.
The Elliot Ness and the Untouchables, yeah. But we have a very healthy economy. We have the healthiest economy in the world by far, by the way. We performed this great experiment with the rest of the world. Many countries in the rest of the world locked down to stop COVID, but they didn't invest the kind of money we invested in vaccines. We didn't lock down anywhere near as tightly as most other countries did. As a result, we had a very, very high mortality rate from COVID relative to other countries initially. But now we're not as vaccinated as we need to be, but we're, as our percentage of vaccinations are concerned, we're the highest of any large developed economic entity in the world. And as a result, our economy is roaring ahead of everyone else's. The experiment is working. The economy is doing wonders, but we are not alone in the world. And as a result, the Delta variant sweeping through India and popping up in places in China is going to affect our economy. We're still going to have bottlenecks. So just be prepared for those to happen. They're going to happen. They're going to happen in unexpected places. There's going to be bumps and grinds along the way. But bottom line, I want to say this very clearly, I think we're in the roaring 20s.
Yeah, I think we're seeing that. Productivity is up. We're automating in a way that we haven't. I mean, service industry has a big productivity boost from computers and so on. Manufacturing is having a new industrial revolution. I mean, the automation revolution, it's industrialization automated. And that,
yeah, the IHS market manufacturing PMI, which is Purchasing Managers Index, we came in at 59.7. Anything above 50 is growth. And it was 63.7 in June, but just began, and there's some headlines out there about the fact that growth has peaked. Well, growth has peaked in the sense that you can only grow so fast, and anything above 60 is unheard of and unsustainable. So we're now down to 59.7, which is still very, very fast. And I think we're seeing this growth, and it will continue all the way through this year and into 2022 for sure.
Right. Thanks for listening so far. Those of you that actually are. If you're not listening, well, no thanks to you, huh? And you can't even hear us being rude to you. Ha, ha, ha.
I'm listening.
We're going to play some commercials. If you would like to join the conversation, we've had some pretty good questions so far today. Our email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or The Personal Wealth Coach. And we'll be back on the other side of these very important announcements from our sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. We've got about 12 minutes left in this this week's episode. 2 hours just flies by. We are happy to talk about what
you... Are we having fun?
I think so. I mean, there's lots of good things to talk about. This is a big one. I meant to talk about this last week and didn't. The U.S. median home price hit the new high in June. Median.
Yep.
The median is right in the middle. So it's not the average. The median is if you took $1 million and $0 and $500,000 right in the middle. Well, the U.S. median home price is $363,300. That's a record. It's never been that high before. That is a big deal. It means that...
What's that number again? Say the number again.
363,300. So why is it going up? Because we haven't built houses very quickly for a long time, because the last disaster economically was a housing bubble. So we had the opposite of that. We had the housing... What's a negative bubble? An inverted bubble?
And the negative bubble is a collapse.
These analogies don't reverse very well. It's a collapse. But what about when it's the opposite of a bubble, so that there was less houses being made? It's a sinkhole, but you see, it's not really a negative space. It's just a down space.
A slump.
Maybe slump. That'll work. So we didn't have enough houses built. And this is something over the past 8 years, easily, we've talked about this, that the housing prices are heading for a big upward move. We're not building houses. Millennials are eventually going to want to move out of the basement. We will see this. Yes, the statistics say they don't want a new house right now, but at some point they will. Well, guess what? They did. They do. It's just a fact of life that eventually people don't like to live with their parents anymore, at least in the United States. And parents are selling houses and buying new houses, but the housing market with new people coming into it, there's more new people coming in than new houses. This is supply and demand, folks. That means house prices go up. That means that if there's a shortage in lumber prices go up fast. And that's what we've been seeing. So lumber prices are back down to normal or semi-normal, almost normal. They're still
bumping up again because of the wildfires.
Yeah, they're still a bit elevated. And with the wildfires, not flowers or flyers, these are big things. These are, and the way forestry works is it takes a long time to grow a tree. I know that's shocking to a lot of people, but if we didn't make the decision to grow enough trees in the past and we cut them all down now, well, it's going to limit our growth into the future. And when fires are coming out and burning down a lot of the trees that we had planned to use for other things, this is a problem long term. So fire issues are going to be part of lumber prices. It's not the big reason why housing prices are up. I mean, we'll develop other technologies to do that. We're already doing it, and I'm sure everybody's seen the videos of 3D printed houses. They talk about it like this is the newest thing that's going to happen tomorrow. It's going to take a while for that to be the norm, and it's going to take a while for that to be something that is palatable to most people, because it's got a lot of restrictions right now. But we will move that way. We will move to a place where houses will be made in less than a week. We'll be able to build them quickly with very little people on site, and at that point, housing prices are going to drop. Leading up to that point, housing prices are going to drop. And that's just something we should expect. In the meantime, we have a shortage. And that doesn't mean that it's that you don't need a house when you need a house. That's why the shortage exists. So go ahead.
There's a side note to that, when you're done with your subject.
That was it. I'm basically laying it out, is that this is a temporary thing, just like the housing bubble that led to the crash before was temporary. The prices here aren't going to be sustained at the rates that they are, because more houses will eventually be built.
There's likely to be a ripple in the economy very shortly when the foreclosure and eviction rules are dropped.
Right.
Which is very shortly, the end of July, I think it is.
Now, that being
that's
said,
going to make a big change.
There's a lot of money sitting on the sidelines waiting to step in to buy up foreclosed properties, but yeah, it's but still going to have a big impact.
It's going to cause a lot of lower income people to move away from the places where the higher incomes are made.
Right.
Which is going to exacerbate the job shortage. We may see some job issues pop up strictly because of the end of the moratorium on evictions and foreclosures. There's a lot of houses, for example, in the Austin area, and even all the way up to where we are in Salado and maybe even in Temple, that people have not been making their payments on. As a matter of fact,
right.
When Texas stopped its foreclosure moratorium, a lot of houses were foreclosed on. A lot of houses in a very short period of time were foreclosed on. Texas, by the way, this is a little interesting point, has ended the extra $300 federal unemployment. Still has 6.5% unemployment in the state. The unemployment insurance ending has not had any measurable effect on unemployment in the states where it's been ended, which indicates that there's something else going on there. And a lot of the something else that's going on, maybe it's certainly not all of it, but a big piece of it, is housing affordability. There is an exodus from the places where the jobs are to the places where the jobs aren't, because people can't afford to live where the jobs are. And you say, well, why can't they just commute? And if you've tried to drive into Austin at 8 o'clock in the morning, you'll understand why they can't commute. So there's a lot of things going on in the economy. There's a lot of moving parts, but be prepared for some more ripples.
Right. So
the end of that moratorium is going to have an effect.
Just as a side note, forbearance in the mortgage market is something that we don't generally see. You see it in the student loan market. So like the Mortgage Bankers Association's coming out with numbers on this, and the numbers have dropped a little bit. It was much higher. It says share of mortgage loans and forbearance decreases to 3.5%. Usually that number is zero. There's no such thing as forbearance in the mortgage market. 3.5% of mortgages in forbearance is a really big number. People here are 3.5% and they think that's no big deal. It's a big number. There's a lot of houses. If you think almost 4 out of every 100 homes is not making their payments. Traditionally, delinquent payments fall under the 1% number in the United States. People tend to make their mortgage payments. So just knowing that forbearance is out there, and that doesn't make the debt go away, it means their mortgages are bigger. And at the end of this, when forbearance goes away, they're going to have to make payments on a larger balance, which means that their monthly payment will be higher coming in from not being able to afford the payment that they already have. This is a real problem. And when we look at evictions for rentals, when we look at all of that, we're not out of the woods yet, is what we're saying. It's, if you listen to the rest of our program, we're talking glowingly about productivity and about the next industrial revolution of automation and how you invest in your own self and so on. There are a lot of problems that are pandemic related that are still here and that we have not gotten through yet. We're going to have to face those bumps. And when it happens, you should see some fluctuations in the real estate market, and you'll see fluctuations in the stock market. It's going to happen. Everybody's going to act like it's a big surprise when it occurs. There's going to be a lot of volatility. The good news on that is there's still a lot of cash sitting on the sidelines waiting to step in and buy cheap, what they see as low-priced things. They're missing out on a lot of really good buys in the market right now at the same time that they're purchasing up stocks that probably shouldn't be purchased up. But that's the nature of the stock market at any point in history, that there's good decisions and bad decisions.
I think you mentioned this last week, but the U.S. life expectancy fell by 1.5 years in 2020, the biggest decline since World War II, which tells you something about what's going on in the economy, what's going on with COVID. There's a unexplained high death rate, which makes a lot of researchers suspect that there's a lot of people who died of COVID that weren't recorded as dying of COVID.
Right.
Now, some of them died of drug overdoses and suicide and things like that.
Heart attack when they didn't want to go to the hospital to get COVID. Things that were not COVID, but also COVID related.
But we lost the average life expectancy in the United States. The American life expectancy dropped to 77.3 years in 2020. That's the lowest since 2003. It is the biggest decline since 1943. which is something to look at very carefully, because 1943, the reason the life expectancy dropped is we were killing millions of people.
It was wartime.
It's wartime. And a lot of people are really unhappy about that. So just be aware that that's going to have an effect on the economy, too. And we're about out of time. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, which is not only the name of the radio program, it's also the name of this SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas. And we do give fiduciary investment advice, management, and wealth management to people who are at or near financial independence. And if you'd like to contact us off the air, we do have voicemail on the weekends, live, real live people, not a phone tree answering the phone during the week, at 254-947-1111.
Or you can reach that locally at 254, well, I already said that, toll free, 1-800.
Toll free on your landline.
914-7526. It's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got radio programs going back lots of years. We've got newsletters going back lots of years. Check it out. See what we said before and after. You can contact us directly through the contact form. Our podcasts are available anywhere. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. We do read those things. Thank you very much for listening. You guys have a fantastic rest of your week.